Hello, listeners, and welcome to today's episode of Women with Issues. I am Tracy Maxwell Hurd, and I have my partner, Diane Calivers, with me. Say hello, Diane.
Hello. Welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us again today. We are creeping ever closer to Election Day, and we are continuing to try to bring you relevant and important information and conversation that will help you make your decisions around all of the issues that are going to be before you in this upcoming election. Primarily, I guess we all know the one at the top is the presidential election. And we have a number of organizations of women that have come together, just galvanized by the fact that we are recognizing our power, which is one of the reasons that Diane and I even started this podcast, as we've shared with you from an AARP article in which there was a poll that indicated that 95% of women over 50 were going to vote in this upcoming presidential election, which is unprecedented. So our conversation has really been around making sure that you know that we have this power and that we are preparing to take advantage of this in this upcoming election. Yeah. Wherever you fall. So today we have a very special guest with us, and her name is Talise Murray. Talise is the Regional Organizing Director for the Midwest of Supermajority. Welcome to Women with Issues today, Talise.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to talk to you both today.
Well, we're excited to talk to you as well. So we're going to just get right into it here. And if you would just kind of share with us a little bit about what supermajority is, how it came to be, and the majority rules.
Absolutely, absolutely. Supermajority was founded just under 18 months ago in April of 2019 by a group of badass women from across the country, including Alicia Garza, Cecile Richards, and Aijin Po, to say that we are absolutely tired of women's issues being put on the sidelines instead of at the front of every conversation as they deserve to be.
Okay, and let me interrupt you a second. Tell me a little bit about the women that came together to start this, because I think a couple of those names sounded kind of familiar to me.
Absolutely. So our co-founders includes Cecile Richards, the former president of Planned Parenthood, Alicia Garza, which is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Global Network. Okay. We have Aijin Po, which is the executive director of National Domestic Workers Alliance. And we also have Jess Morales-Riquetto, who is the executive director of Care in Action and the political director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance.
Excellent. Some heavy hitters. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us more.
Yes. So we know that women's rights and women's equity is not a special interest group. We are 51% of the population in the United States, and our issues and our values are not represented at that way. And so supermajorities mission and our vision is to make sure that women know that they have the voice and the political power to make sure that our values and our views and visions are represented and heard. And this was all fueled by our majority rules, which came as a result of a national bus tour, international research, and online polling of over 75,000 women from all 50 states of all ethnicities, backgrounds, generations, and races. Okay. To say, what are the most important things that we want to see, not only out of our political representation, but out of our communities, out of our community leaders, and out of the laws that are being written. And so these 75,000 unique women came up with these five rules. Okay. That our lives are safe, that we can live a life free of fear and intimidation at home, at work, and in our neighborhoods, that our bodies are respected, that the healthcare system takes our needs seriously and takes the needs and importance of treatment and research around women as a forefront, that our work is valued, that we are paid equally for the work, and that we are promoted equally, but also recognizing that jobs such as caregiving and teaching are supported and valued at the same way as other fields and other work. Rule number four, our families are supported, that we are no longer forced to make impossible and unfair choices between family and work, that women are no longer required to bear the burden of making all the family decisions. in rule number 5, that our government represents us. From school board and city council all the way to the White House, women are 51% of the electorate and therefore deserves to have their right to vote and their rights and needs protected and promoted at every level of government.
Wow, that's quite a lot. Diane, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. You said you based it on the responses from 75,000 women. And yes. I just wanted you to clarify, are you a nonpartisan organization? Is that women from all political parties represented?
Yeah. So Supermajority is a 501c3, 501c4 organization. And this work was done out of our 501c3. So this work was done across political parties, across racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and it's a multi-generational poll as well.
Awesome. Well, that kind of falls right in line with the group that we have been speaking to. So we would have been a part of that sample. And that is a pretty significant size sample as well. 75,000 is pretty significant. So I'm really impressed by what came out of this and how you guys chose to actually present that. So it's more than equal pay that you're talking about, but even looking at what those specific career tracks are and getting mm-hmm. some equity around those kind of based on what, you know, their contributions are to society. Like, for example, teachers, hugely underpaid, but, you know, who impacts generations and develops generations, you know, over and over again, if not our teachers. And we certainly know they're not getting equal pay. Have you guys like pushed any agenda out of this? Have you been part of advocating for any legislation or how are you working to make these 5 roles relevant or how are you trying to manifest them in society?
Absolutely. So to date, Supermajority has not advocated for specific legislation. Instead, we advocate for policy and leaders. And so we always say, if someone is willing to say, we will listen and put women to the forefront, mm-hmm. that's what we do. So as a new organization, our priority is starting with the women on the ground floor. We are talking to women from every state to mobilize and empower them to vote, to make their voices heard. Because we know that when women mobilize, mm-hmm. when they become a larger and more active part of the electorate, those people that they elect are more likely to put their needs first. And so we have endorsed the Biden-Harris ticket.
Okay.
But to date, we have not endorsed any specific policy because our goal right now is to remind every single woman in this country that they have the ability to not only decide their school board elections, but to decide the election of the presidency, the Senate, and every election in between.
Sure. And you just spoke to the fact that you've really been trying to mobilize women on the ground, which is so key. Because when you look at us being the majority of the population, we are not represented in these seats of power. So what is it that you guys are doing in terms of voter engagement, increasing voter participation? What are you doing at the ground level?
Absolutely. So we have volunteers that represent every single state and as well as some citizens abroad mm-hmm. that does this work of reaching out to women where they are and having conversations with them, whether that's via text message, phone calling, or letter writing. We are utilizing community organizing where it's women like us talking to other women about why they vote, why it's important, and then connecting them with the needed resources. Because one of the things we know is that women wear a lot of hats in their lives. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, unlike any other year, the laws have constantly been changing around voters' rights and voters' equity. And we have to make sure that they know what their rights are and what they need to know. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we do is we say, here's all the information you need so that we remove the barriers of you having to scour your Secretary of State's website for the dates for registration deadlines. We remove the barrier of saying, well, how do I request my absentee ballot or where do I find my polling location? We're giving you all that information, whether it's through a phone call or through a text bank or through letter writing so that you have that information right there for you so that we can hopefully, by removing that one big barrier, we're one step closer to getting to the polling booth.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
I think that a lot of us, especially for myself as a mother, particularly in this election, I have 3 sons that are aged 22, 23, and 24. And this year, especially, I've just taken it upon myself to make sure they have a voting plan. you know, calling them, texting them. I have one son in the military that I reached out to the other day and I said, hey, don't wait to see if you're off that day to see if you can vote or not. Make a plan. Will you promise me that? And he said, yeah, I will do that. So, you know, as mothers, as caregivers, you know, that's typically been our job. And especially with supermajority and the text banks and the phone banks, really having us, you know, reach out beyond maybe our immediate family and, you know, do that job. Absolutely. Of making sure that everyone has a voting plan.
Where is supermajority in terms of the whole voter disenfranchisement thing? You know, there's lots of conversation around early voting and mail voting with the post office. And last week, the president was encouraging people in the debate to go out and be poll watchers, which isn't unusual. There are poll watchers all the time. But, you know, that's an orchestrated effort. It's not just random people showing up, you know, who have no authority in the election process at all. So, you know, what are you guys thinking and how are you planning around trying to address disenfranchisement, you know, ahead of Election Day and on Election Day?
So I think the first thing we have to do is base ourselves in reality. Voter disenfranchisement, especially voter disenfranchisement of women and women of color, is not new. Right. In fact, it is deeply embedded in our entire electoral process. And we do face new hurdles this election year with schooling being online, with COVID-19, and with the state of our United States Postal Service. And so one of the things that we are doing in supermajority is, one, while we are encouraging everyone to vote as early as possible, we are also trying to make sure we provide everyone with everything they need to know all the options of how to vote. So while we are encouraging people to vote by absentee, by mail, or vote early, we are also saying you can also vote early, you know, by going into your clerk's office, or you can vote safely on Election Day. And recognizing that due to this legacy of disenfranchisement, people have a different relationship with different types of voting, and making sure that in our voter contact, we are respecting that. And as we're talking about trying to combat this disenfranchisement, one of the things that we know is that in order to fully eradicate voter disenfranchisement, we need representatives in these spaces that are going to fight and advocate. And so what that means is we have to make sure that we go out and vote and do everything we can. And actually, the thing that you talked about, Diane, of making a plan is exactly the thing. We know all too often that, you know, people will say, yeah, I'm going to go vote. Yeah, I'm registered. And then on the day of, they don't know where their polling location is, or they can't find their ID. And now
I got to work.
Mm-hmm. Or, oh crap, the line is too long, I don't have enough time. Mm-hmm. And so by having people make a plan and giving people all the options, we are slowly breaking down those barriers to hopefully having full states where there is no more systematic voter disenfranchisement. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm so proud of is that we're reaching voters that oftentimes are not typically engaged in the process. We are talking to women all throughout the country. And not only that, but our volunteers come from all throughout the country. And we know that when someone is volunteering in the electoral process, they're going to tell their friends and family about it because you're going to talk about it.
Sure.
So we want to make sure that in every pocket of this country, people know all their rights, because knowing your rights is the greatest combat to misinformation. When someone is coming in saying, you can't do that, if you say, yes, I can, I have the right to be here, I have the right to vote this day, that is the greatest way to combat all of this information that's coming out from social media, from elected representatives, and from just people in the community.
Absolutely. It's especially important, you know, for our listeners, women over 50 this year, who don't want to be exposed to the virus.
You know, absolutely.
Have that plan to not maybe get, like you were saying earlier, barriers. You know, they get to their polling location and they see this big crowd of people and it scares them off. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to go in there.
Yeah, and that's perfectly understandable. We know, like, research tells us that there are demographics that does not trust absentee voting, that does not trust early voting. And so then how do we ensure that those people feel safe on Election Day? But then on the other side, like you said, Diane, how do we make sure that those that are at higher risk for infection from COVID-19 know all of their rights for voting early. They know that they need to have a signature or a second secrecy seal on their absentee ballots. And they know that they need two stamps to mail it back, mm-hmm. you know, and those are those little details, those little pieces of information. Those are the key. That's how we're going to make sure that every voice and vote is heard in November.
You're absolutely right. I think, as in all things, but this specifically, you know, information is really, really key. You know, things like the fact that there are polling locations themselves are going to change mm-hmm. because so many schools, you know, depending on where you are, I know in Ohio, schools are big for being used as polling locations. Mm-hmm. Understanding that schools are closed, period, in many places, that creates a problem. Schools may be open, but maybe they're only open certain days, and that doesn't happen to be Tuesday. So, you know, really having that information locked down about knowing where you're going. But, you know, more importantly, understanding that if you are intimidated by, you know, the COVID virus, and, you know, who isn't, I won't say anything, but, you know, most of us are, that mailing is safe. You know, mailing is a safe option for voting. It happens all the time. Absolutely. Our military has done it since, what, World War II? You know, without any issue, we've got, I think it's 9 states that's yeah. all they do is vote.
Yeah. And mail. States like Colorado and Oregon, they have for the last few decades voted solely by mail. And we know that that goes off without a hitch. And we know that voter fraud is one of the rarest forms of disenfranchisement.
Absolutely.
And we know that it's a way that people can access their vote while being safe.
Absolutely.
But we also want to remind people that there are options. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that while this process is safe, some people just like the joy of going in and voting on election day.
That's true of a lot of older seniors,
mm-hmm.
And it's true of a lot of African Americans, because yeah. you know, there was such a struggle around getting that right to vote.
Yes,
that, you know, there's just something about showing up on election day, you know, at your polling location or at the board if that's where it happens to be this time. But showing up in person on election day is really still a source of pride for many people and really important. And I mean, even, you know, some of my peers, and it's become like a family thing. You know, we go mm-hmm. together to vote, you know, that kind of thing. So
going back yeah. to work with your sticker.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
I voted sticker.
Exactly. Yeah, I voted sticker, taking pictures, taking your child for the first time to go vote.
For sure.
People have traditions around it. And while we want to make sure that everyone is voting, we want to make sure that everyone's voting safely. So if that's wanting to go in person, we're going to help you make a plan so that you are able to vote in person safely by doing exactly what Diane mentioned, making sure you're off of work, making sure you know where you have to be, and how long is it going to take?
Right, right, right. So you mentioned something around misinformation when you were speaking in your last statement that you made. There are thousands of cable channels now, and I don't know how many social media outlets and how many people on those outlets giving, you know, support, supposedly valid information. You know, and everything moves so quickly. You know, it used to be just the newspaper, and if there was something printed incorrectly in the newspaper, there was a retraction, although the retraction generally was never on the front page like the incorrect information was, but at least, you know, you didn't have that far to look to really find something if an error had been made. But now, you know, what are the odds of you even capturing that same audience again? And, you know, how do you deal when you're trying to communicate with the number of people that an organization like Supermajority is? You know, what do you do about misinformation? How do you try to combat that and effectively respond to it so that your followers really know what the real deal is?
So we do a collection of things, and we know, as I mentioned before, the greatest combatant for misinformation is fact, but that's rooted in trust. So Supermajority works very hard to make sure that our community of volunteers and the community of women that we work with know that we will always keep them up to date on information. And the way that we do that is we always, always refer to the experts in our fields. So whether that is directly linking someone to the Secretary of State's website, or if that's saying, based on this new court case that came out yesterday, we're not directing people to other places. We're directing them to the source, to the root of the information. And we also want to make sure that women know how to digest all of that.
Right.
When we're sending them, you know, here's the Secretary of State's website, we always do, well, what does that mean? And we are in constant communication with our volunteers, because our volunteers are the one reaching out to women all across the country and all across the world about what their rights are and what they need to do.
Great. I know, I'm big on that. Tracy and I are both journalists, trained journalists. And, you know, when somebody posts something on Facebook, for example, I'm the first one to say, cite your source. No. So I have another question. You know, we know that women are 51% of the population, and we vote in higher numbers than men. Additionally, we learned from recently on our last podcast from Dr. Amanda Weinstein, Eaton, an economist, that we have influence in 80% of consumer spending, including large purchases. So with so much power or alleged, you know, potential power, why are we not more represented, do you think, in politics, in business, corporate boards?
We are.
That is a question, Talisa.
Good question. You're right. But I mean, it's true. We are 51% of the electorate and the majority of volunteers, donors, and voters, and yet do not have the legislative and political power. And a large part of that is rooted in the fact that they elected officials didn't have to make us mm-hmm. the front lines of the issues and of the conversation.
Well, and I guess maybe the better question is, how are you supporting women and encouraging women to step up and get involved in politics and policy and leaning in business?
Absolutely. So I think the very first thing that we always want to do when we're talking to people is reminding them that their voice and their vote matters, because we have reached an era where people, especially in the last decade, people feel like their voice doesn't really matter and that their experience isn't valued. And that makes people a lot less likely to vote, a lot less likely to run for office, and a lot less likely to reach out to other elected officials. So by empowering women and reminding them that their voice and their vote matters and carries value, you are empowering them to take those actions, but also by holding our elected officials accountable, mm-hmm. by saying that we are demanding that you do these things in order to protect the lives and bodies of women, mm-hmm. in order to make sure that the work that women do is valued. And it is having those clear and firm objectives, ranging from healthcare to the economy, that we can demand of our elected officials as we are working to build the largest women-to-women voter contact, that we're saying that's still not enough. You still have to put us at the front line of your policy. And if you want to be elected official, you have to make sure that you are doing these things, because we are part of this country. We are valuable. Our voices are important, and therefore we deserve to be heard in every aspect.
Right. And we do that with our vote, and we do that mm-hmm. with our money. And I think, you know, Tracy and I, we remember, you know, the days of the good old boys, and now it's so much different with the Me Too movement and with what you were saying about respecting women, respecting women's bodies, and holding people accountable. I had a job, for example, in my 20s when I was a sales rep and was moved up the ranks and became a regional sales vice president. And mm-hmm. it was just brutal. I mean, I stepped down from that job after about a year because I could not take the good old boys network. It was just not working for me.
Yeah.
And I think now a woman in that position would have a much better chance of succeeding. So I think that's what happened. You know, a lot of women just say, hey, it's just not worth it. And so much different now, I hope.
I think we're galvanizing our power a little more. I think organizations like Supermajority help women find space for their voice and build a collective. You know, it's often difficult to be the first, the only. And I think that's the real value that we get out of organizations like Supermajority. It's not telling you what to think or how to believe, because, you know, the first thing you did was you came up with the majority rules, which were determined and dictated by women mm-hmm. from all over. So, you know, there's no there's no imposing of thought or, you know, direction. And I like that it is built by the women that comprise the organization. But, you know, we have to, you use the word value, and that's so important that we have to value ourselves first. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've been the majority for a minute. that's not new, but we are kind of finally coming into recognizing, you know, hey, why is there such an imbalance? And believing that there is something that we can actually do about that. And you see the tide, you know, kind of changing now, you know, with the huge sweep in Congress and, you know, representation of women. Because, you know, you were speaking to your fifth point was making sure that government represents us. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of government representing us is us representing us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and being in those rooms as well, because, you know, how many times have we seen panels of all white men dealing with issues of, you know, women's reproductive rights or women's health issues? And it's like, really, how do you look around that room and not see the absence or the void in the conversation that you're having? So, I mean, I think that's really key. But do you guys do anything around encouraging women specifically to go out and actually run for office?
So, yes and no.
Okay.
So we do not specifically launch programming to help women run for office. There are many great partners across the country that does that. Okay. What we do is we always remind women of one of the things that I've learned in this work is that a lot of times we don't know what these offices do. And because of that, we don't see the value of those offices.
Exactly.
And so by educating people on, let's talk about down ballot, or let's look past the president and the Senate. And when we're working with our volunteers, when we're working with our community members, we are communicating that with them. We are saying, you know, don't forget to turn the ballot over.
Right.
Don't forget to go past the partisan side. And those types of things reminds us of the power of these offices. We also, one of the things that we love doing is amplifying the work that women are doing. Tracy, you hit it the nail on the head with, you always see these panels of all white men talking about issues that are really a woman's issue, because let's be honest, every issue is a woman's issue. So there should never be a panel about a woman.
Exactly.
And so one of the things we do is we also amplify leaders in the space. We will partner with organizations and we will promote panels and workshops so that people know there are women leaders in these spaces. There are people that are representing you. Because one of the things that we know, I come from an organizing background. It is hard to enter into a space that you feel like is not made for you. Sure. It is hard to want to be involved in something where no one looks like you. And so we want to remind people, no, people here do look like you. Mm-hmm. People here do care about the things that you care about, and we have those same experiences. Mm-hmm. Because by encouraging people to say, don't forget about school board, and also by promoting Hispanic women voices and Black female voices and Asian Pacific Islander voices, we are now reminding them not only are these offices important, but your voices are important, and the voices of your experience and your knowledge is important. And we see those compounding together. And we know this year, more women ran for U.S. Congress than ever before. Right. There were more women running for U.S. Congress than this year than there were seats in U.S. Congress.
Right. That's
huge.
We have more women of color running for office in the top like 100 cities in this country based on population than ever before. Mm-hmm. We are seeing this change. When women remembers the power of a school board or the power of city clerks, and then combined with my voice is important, my experience is valuable, and I can speak to that. And we see that trickle down to these historic numbers. I mean, in 2018, we saw the most female House, and we're preparing for the day we have the first female vice president. So we are seeing this ability to empower women around their value and the importance of their voice translate into women running for office.
Exactly. Well, good conversation that we're having here today with Talise Murray of Supermajority. Stay with us. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
I saw that you are a member of the We Demand More organization, which I just joined after looking at the Supermajority's website. And we know from our last podcast from the economist, Dr. Weinstein, that women are bearing the burden of the coronavirus pandemic more than men. They're more, the deaths are not higher among women, they're higher among men, but they're impacted in terms of being the caregivers. Women tend to take caregiving jobs. They're the caregiving professionals, nurses, daycare workers, healthcare workers, nursing home workers. And so, you know, we are, you know, we're exposed, but, you know, that's what we do as women, as nurturers.
Absolutely. It is. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Women work in fields and in spaces that often are not valued at the same level. But we also know that women are often the ones that bear the burden of the familial decisions when things change. Actually, a good friend of mine a few weeks ago posted on Facebook, she was watching her goddaughter, and her goddaughter is in virtual learning due to the coronavirus. And so my friend, she and her wife was going to watch their goddaughter while she's in class. And they said, okay, we both had a full day's worth of work ready. We work from home. It's great. And after 9 hours of school, they said that they had a combined maybe 35 minutes of work done.
Right.
And what does that tell you, right? When you, we're looking at people who are not able to do both. We can't wear both hats in this environment. And we're seeing women across this country have to make the decision between family and work, which goes directly in the face of the majority rules that were put up by these women across the country, where we say our families are supported. And unfortunately, the way that our society is built is that women are, they bear the burden of these types of environments. We know that women are the ones typically sitting next to their kids while they're doing classwork and trying to fit in their regular job in between their kids' classes.
Right.
But also, as we know, as you guys mentioned, women are more likely to be teachers and nurses and caregivers. So they're on the front lines. And we do not we are not represented in the way that we should. They are going to be deeply impacted. And so, especially on the economic stance, Supermajority had a few demands that we released a few weeks ago, as well as on the healthcare demands, because this is, it's going to take generations for women to fully recover from the Trump administration and from the COVID-19 economic and social impact. And in order for us to even begin that recovery, there has to be things that take place.
Can you share what some of those demands are?
Absolutely. So for the economic stability of our country, because we know women are the backbone of this nation, women want and deserve leaders to provide immediate relief during this pandemic and after the pandemic. And that can be done in a few ways. There needs to be a monthly stimulus package sent to people in this country for 12 months so that we know that these women are not being required to make the choice between taking care of their families and providing for their families.
Excellent.
By extending an expanded unemployment benefit at the $600 level through the end of the year, because we know so many women had to leave their jobs to take care of their children, or that their jobs were cut as a result of the current coronavirus.
Take care of their children or their grandchildren.
Yeah, absolutely.
We see a lot of that in our demographic. My sister's one of them. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. I know quite a few people. My cousin was raised by our grandmother. It is. Familial and grandparent adoption is one of the most common things we see in this country. And when people are losing out on this unemployment benefit, they are not able to put the needs of their family first.
Exactly.
We need to be creating more affordable housing options for our communities across the country, because as we are seeing these rent moratoriums and eviction moratoriums, and we are seeing families across this country lose housing in the middle of the greatest pandemic we have seen at the international level in over a century. That is in a direct face of protecting the lives of women and the lives of families, and it is not acceptable. And then we also, so importantly, we need to provide more funding for our state and local governments so that they can protect and support our communities. Our state and local governments are the ones who are dealing with these, you know, educational funding and with the food banks and with the domestic violence shelters and homeless shelters. And our states and local governments need additional funding to be able to support all of the women in our country during this crisis.
Absolutely. Yeah, that local funding thing is a huge one. When I was serving in office in the legislature, we were going through coming out of the recession, and what continually got cut was funding to local governments and education funding, mm-hmm. which are probably the last two things that should ever get cut. And we still have not yet, funding has been restored, but we still have not yet restored it to pre-recession funding level, let alone gone beyond that, which, you know, it wasn't sufficient before we even started making the cuts. So, you know, imagine with all the challenges that we have now and how this is impacting local municipalities and our schools. I mean, you know, they're dealing with challenges that they never had to deal with before in terms of trying mm-hmm. to try to keep kids educated. And now with that, you know, on top of it, sure, you're not paying for the same amount in heating anymore, but, you know, we're still paying our teachers. We still have to get school supplies to our students. We still have to, you know, make sure that they're able to receive and return their schoolwork and, you know, and all.
I think that, you know, if you had more women in politics, more women making policy, money would be spent differently. Mm-hmm. It would not be taken away from education. Kids would have what they need to have to learn. But you know, there are places, you know, my husband heard of a friend the other day who has a nephew living with him. This kid, he has an iPad, but mm-hmm. it does no good without Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. No internet, you know, and this isn't an isolated case. You know, you hear about this and it's just like when you hear about Feed America is mm-hmm. going crazy right now. They don't have enough food. And you think in America, this can't happen. Children can't be going hungry. They do. They do. I've seen it firsthand. I was a foster parent. People don't have internet. Internet is necessary. It isn't a luxury anymore. People mm-hmm. need access to information. You are behind the ball if you don't have internet.
Yeah, and the real divide is real when you're talking about living in disparity, whether you're an adult and you're trying to find a job, you know, all of those postings are online. You know, you don't go to the post office anymore, or, you know, there's not a jobs board. So, I mean, mm-hmm. and both still exist, I guess, if you go to the unemployment office, but I mean, that's not where you're going to find the majority of information. And especially now that you can actually do searches, you know, globally, anywhere in the world, you know, maybe it requires you making a move, which could be a whole nother challenge in and of itself. But, you know, the digital divide impacts everything from education to employment to healthcare. I mean, that's how we communicate with our physicians now and get results from procedures and tests and things that we've had done in the hospitals. That's how you get your COVID results in most cases now. Mm-hmm. You get a COVID test, you know.
And we know that I remember when, you know, in March when everything shut down rapidly and they said, it's fine, we'll just all go remote. I remember hearing from students and parents across the state of Michigan saying, well, we're from a rural town. Our internet doesn't support four people being on video all day.
Right.
And, you know, even here in Lansing where, you know, it's the capital of Michigan, so everyone has internet, right? That's the idea. But we have people saying, I have internet, but not enough for two of my kids and me and my spouse to all be on it all day. Right. And we're starting to finally see internet and connectivity as a necessity because it does it more deeply impact, right? We're talking about our low income populations. We're talking about our rural populations who are not able to fully engage, even more so now with the libraries and schools closed. Mm-hmm. They are not able to get all the things that they need. I remember I had a friend who went all the way through college without a laptop. She wrote all of her papers at the library because she couldn't afford a laptop.
Right.
And now everything's online. What are we doing to support those people? What are we doing to support those that do not have all those resources? Because they're still an important part of our community.
For sure. And
I think that's one of the biggest things that has been exposed during COVID-19 is how much we as a society and we as people who work in politics and those in our elected offices take it for granted, certain things and access. And it's not just internet and Wi-Fi, you know, internet, Wi-Fi and laptops. It's also family structure where it's fine. You can just do this from home. Why is there things happening in the background? It should be absolutely silent.
Right.
What do you mean you don't have a place to do this?
Right.
And, you know, some schools not figuring out a system to feed their children. These are all things that fall on the parents. And 9 times out of 10, it falls on the mother. Where we're talking about, okay, now I have my 5 kids at home, but I still have to go to work. I can't get off work. Where are my kids going to go? My kids were fed by the school. So now I have to provide 5 more meals every single day because I have 5 kids. Okay, where do I get the money to feed everyone lunch and breakfast when they usually get that from school?
For sure.
And we need to have elected officials who are looking at that, who are saying these are important because those are the things that impacts our families. And those are the things that are going to be always in the front part of our minds. So it needs to be in the front of our elected officials' minds.
For sure. If it is not part of your experience, it will not be part of your consideration. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we have to get women in offices, in the room, in these seats around the table. But beyond that, we have to support them when we get them there.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not just about the last stop is not just getting a woman in the room. It is continuing to advocate and let it be known that her position is supported, which will give weight to her position and to the issues that she puts forward. Otherwise, you just have someone in the room who's not being heard. You know, that's the first step to get someone in there. But, you know, we as community have to continue to advocate and learn how to do that. You know, one of the worst things that I ever experienced and had no knowledge of until I was part of the process was committees. You know, this is where all legislation and budget conversations and all those things begin. Mm-hmm. And in the finance committee, when the budget's going on, it's pretty busy in there. But that aside, there are huge issues that are determined and decided in a room where there's no one there except for the legislator, the lobbyists who have interest in it, and a few staffers. There's not one single person that is not paid to be in that room there. And that's unacceptable because it's free. It's the people's house. You know, there's nothing to stop you. No, you don't need an appointment. No one would ask you why you're here. I mean, well, security would probably say, what are you here for today? You say, I'm here for committee, and you go to committee. That's it. But that makes such a big difference. Legislators respond completely different when there's a room full of people watching face to face what they're doing, what they're saying, versus when it's just them and their colleagues, you know, in the room. I've witnessed it. And, you know, just like we're talking about women understanding our power going into this process, our power doesn't stop on election day. And we have to understand all of these places where we can make our presence and our power known in between election day. You know, all of those things are critical and have significant impact if we engage.
Right. And also our power doesn't stop at age 50. You know, I really hope that Supermajority and other organizations, I know you have leaders that are over 50 there at Supermajority. You know, we have been the CEOs of our families. We have been the CEOs of the healthcare in our families, raising children. We know what it takes to raise children, to educate children. We know what the resources are, how much it costs. We've made spending decisions for our families over 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we have experience. We can run a budget. And so we have a lot of value. And, you know, you look at our heroes like RBG. And, you know, so if you're 50, you're certainly not done. It used Absolutely. To be, you know, and it is difficult. I mean, if you've taken time off, we've talked a lot about this, 20 years or even just a few years to raise children. It is tough. It is hard as hell getting back into that workforce sometimes. It was for me. You know, we need to, you know, respect, you know, the work that women have done while out of the quote unquote workforce.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, even caring for our aging parents, you know, you learn a lot there. Mm-hmm. We're all going to have, you know, most of us will have aging parents. You know, drug prices, the cost of health care, you know, those kinds of things, we know.
And we know how to advocate for those things. You know, we advocate every time we take our children or our parents to the doctors. We advocate every time we go to a PTA meeting and, you know, all of these things. So as Diane said, we're engaging in all of these arenas and advocating and impacting those systems all the time. But when it comes to the areas and the arenas where the decisions are made at a community and societal level, suddenly we disqualify ourselves mm-hmm. as if we don't have that expertise or that knowledge. And we're living it every single day, more so than men in many cases, because how many men take their kids to the doctor or their parents to the doctor? How many men are involved in the PTA and the education of their kids and things? So, you know, the perspective really, in so many cases, really relies only with us because men aren't really a part of that. How are you guys tracking this? So is there a questionnaire that you submit to elected officials to find out what their positions are? Is there a report card that comes out on the back end to say these are the elected officials who align with the things that the women of supermajority have said? How is it that you're identifying these elected officials that are fighting for the agenda that the women of supermajority have put forward?
So we, as I mentioned before, will only be endorsing one president, one candidate, and that'll be the presidential ticket of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris mm-hmm. for the general election. But the way that we do this is mostly through political pressure. We put these demands out, and these demands are sent to these elected officials. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we know that, like you guys said, 75,000 women creating a list of majority rules, and we have volunteers in all 50 states, and we have people that we work with in all 50 states that are all gathering behind this. Tracy, that talks, you're talking about that power and that person sitting in the room looking at you while you're working. I don't know, it's a little bit more powerful than 75,000 women saying that this is important to them.
For sure.
And so we want to make sure, especially in the light of threats to things like the Affordable Care Act and the way that we have seen racial injustice in medical care just put on a spotlight during the COVID-19 pandemic, we are always making sure to hold these elected leaders accountable by sending these demands and sending these challenges to them directly.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, because if we're not communicating with them, you know, shame on us for not letting our demands be known. And I think historically that has really been a big part of the challenge, is that we have been silent and we have been passive. You know, we've had our moments of rising up and then, you know, we just kind of go back to our daily lives and just have to make sure that we're continually in some way. You know, everyone doesn't have to fight for everything every day, but, you know, at least find your one thing. You know, find the one thing that you're going to champion. And if every woman did that with one thing, I can't imagine how impactful that would be. I want to steer the conversation a little bit. A couple of things that we have been talking about here at Women with Issues, and just understanding how supermajority has been comprised and the diversity of the organization from its leadership all the way down through its membership. How has this whole dynamic, not just of COVID-19, but of race relations, impacted the focus of supermajority?
So that's actually a really good segue for me to talk about our super rule, which guides pretty much everything that we do as an organization, that the lives and experiences of women, particularly women of color, are front and center in addressing all of our nation's challenges. Okay. And the reason for that is we say we have to guide and change course based on what is happening in our country. And so in May, when the protests erupted around the country in support of George Floyd, we stopped doing promotion of our own things on social media and on our website in favor of promoting and steering people to the Black Lives Matter websites and pages on both in their states and at the national level, because we felt that in that moment, our job was to be allies. Our job was to direct people to the work that was being done to support and empower the women of color in those states and those regions. And so one of the things that we always say is when you are leading an organization that is multi-generational, interracial, women focused, that means you have to take leads, not just from us, but also from others and our partners in the space. Mm-hmm. One thing that I am proud of is this organization is over 90% people of color. It is 90% women. And do you see that even in our leadership? Mm-hmm. And so when we're making decisions to say we're going to steer our membership base to do work with and to follow the stories coming from Black Lives Matter in those months, that was because that is what we as women and we as leaders and as organizers, what was our responsibility as allies. And now in the light of COVID-19 and the continuing battle that women and women of color particularly are facing, it is our jobs to always talk about, one, how you can keep your family and your body safe throughout this entire process, but also focusing on those stories and uplifting them and saying that you are heard, you are seen, because we know that in this chaos of a year, people feel like they're being lost in the cracks. And we want to make sure that we are directing information and directing empowerment to the places where they deserve to be, even if that's not necessarily us in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, there's so much happening in our country right now, so many issues being challenged, so many things that are being challenged that we thought had been resolved, you know, everything from voters' rights to women's rights to, you know, education, how we are or are not going to fund it or prioritize it. And just at the federal level, all of the changes that have happened around education, but so many things. And certainly with the passing of RBG, the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg, mm-hmm. You know, that kind of throws a whole lot up in the air in terms of what could be reexamined by our Supreme Court. But just something that I wanted to submit to supermajority for consideration. I am part of a coalition, it's called the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. And we just put out a list of some things that we thought we wanted women to consider to kind of get them active and engaged and to say, okay, this is what you have to lose, basically. This is why this election is important. And thinking or assuming that at least one or two of these 20-some issues, you know, would resonate and really, really catapult every woman to go and vote, because at least a handful of these would be important to them on a personal level, you know. And it's everything from, you know, the Affordable Care Act, housing discrimination protections, and Talise, you had mentioned housing earlier and just this whole eviction crisis that we're facing right now. Reproductive rights, immigration protection, affirmative action in college and in employment, gun control, international relations, lending practices, especially around housing and small business lending, climate change, police reform, LGBTQIA rights and protections, civil rights protections, veterans protections.
Domestic violence, absolutely, Diane.
Yeah. Equal pay, prison reform, school safety for girls, social security protection, the right to protest, that's really huge right now. What does that mean and what are you allowed to do? Sexual assault protection, Medicare continuation, Medicaid continuation, fair elections, and government accountability, letting them know where you stand and what your positions are, because this mm-hmm. this appointment has the same gravitas as this presidential election we're about to go into, and the repercussions are even farther lasting than the next president of the United States. Before we let you go here, I just want to find out, is there anything else that supermajority has coming up that we can get involved in and support? And certainly we encourage women to go to supermajority.com and check out their website and find out, you know, who they are, what it is they're engaged with. Join if you feel so inclined. We have, you know, we felt and allying ourselves with them. So Talise, anything else you have that you would like to share with us today?
Absolutely. In the next few weeks, there are two ways for women across the country to get involved in the work that we are doing here at Supermajority. The first would be if you want to get engaged with texting, calling, or writing letters to women across the country. You can always join to be one of our volunteers at supermajority.com/supermajor. And that is our cohort of women that have sent over 1 million text messages and contacted over 4 million women in the last month to give them information on their voting rights.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And then on October 17th, we are having what we call our Women Are Voting campaign to encourage women across the country to cast their votes, to get their, you know, their pod squad together to go and cast their votes, but also connect with people across the country. And you can learn more about that online at mobilize.us/supermajority. And we will be having all types of events, whether it's on social media where we're talking to you guys and we have partners from across the country, whether it's on the ground with you guys voting. We are really trying to make sure that we are taking every opportunity we can to make sure that women are getting their voices and their votes out this November. And so on October 17th, we are making it the Women Are Voting Day, where we are going to try to have as many women cast their votes on that day so that we know they will be counted. So to know more about that, go to mobilize.us/supermajority.
Talise, you are just so impressive, I have to say. Definitely not a woman over 50. You are much, much younger. But it's so, I think Tracy will agree, it's just so exciting to see, you know, someone like you and someone your age just so involved and so engaged like this in women's issues and policy.
Leading the charge. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, I got into politics in quite an interesting way. Actually, as we're talking about the Supreme Court, I got interested into politics as a result of a Supreme Court ruling. I came into the world of politics after seeing the national eruption when the Obergefell case got picked up by the Supreme Court in 2014, the decision that eventually was given in June of 2015 to give same-sex marriage rights in all the land.
Gotcha. There's always something personal that resonates with us to get us engaged, you know, to get us focused on this whole process of civic engagement. And that's why I always say, you know, find what it is, make it personal for you. If it's your kids' education, you know, your parents' health, the economy, whatever it is that is of issue to you in that moment, there is an opportunity for you to get involved and to advocate for that. So our guest today has been Talise Murray, the Regional Organizing Director of the Midwest for Supermajority. Please make sure to check out their website, supermajority.com. Talise, it has been a pleasure. We are so honored to have you with us today, helping women get ready for Election Day.
Thank you.
Pleasure
so much
speaking with you both. Thank you so much for having me.
For sure. We began this journey with you to make sure that you knew how important that we women over 50 are going to be in this election cycle, and not just us, but every single woman, all of our new voters who are newly 18, and this is their first opportunity, all the way up to, you know, our senior women above us who really were part of the battle for us to really be a part of this process. Election Day is Tuesday, November 3rd. So make sure that you're voting to ensure that the people who are getting elected are representing the agenda that you want to see represented.
We are Women with Issues. You can find us. We would love, love, love your feedback. We want and need your feedback. Find us at facebook.com, Women with Issues Podcast. Find us on Instagram and Twitter as Women with Issues. And we'd like to thank our technical producer, Cade Hessman.
Yay, Cade.
Yay, Cade. And we hope all of you keep listening. We appreciate you very, very much. We are Women with Issues.
And we're talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.